For those of you that haven't been with us or maybe don't recall, we're going to be looking initially at some thoughts in 1 Timothy chapter 3. What I want to do tonight is finish some, overview comments on the qualifications. And then I've had several questions given to me, and I'm going to do that afterwards, and I'll just share with you what some of those questions are, and you can kind of be thinking about them. Last night we talked about children, a man ruling his house well, and the children being believers in God, and hopefully ultimately becoming Christians. And somebody after church asked me, "How do you know when your child's ready to be baptized?" So we'll make a comment or two on that. I received a question, can an elder be removed? Another question, can someone recover from not being qualified? Someone has something in their life that disqualifies them. Can they recover from that? And how do you handle an officer who is too busy to really do the function? And another one that came to me was, when our children leave our homes, is there a time lag before they're no longer in our home or in our house from a spiritual standpoint? So some of those will take a little bit more time than others, but I wanted to write them down for my own sake, and some people helped when they wrote theirs down, and we will take note of them. The other thing I want to do, a little bit in housekeeping, it was pointed out to me, and this was totally inadvertent on my part, but in the last part of verse 2 of 1 Timothy 3, I may have skipped hospitality. And that was unintentional. I did give a 30-minute talk on hospitality at Vandalia on Saturday, so that might have been my psycho lapse, I don't know. But I do want to make a few comments on hospitality. Obviously, hospitality is not a hard word for us to understand. It's the same root word that we get hospital from. It's the helping of individuals. And I think you're all good Bible students and know that back then they didn't have Super 8s and Marriott's. So when people traveled, they were more in need of a place to stay, although I'm sure lots of times we know they stayed in caves and probably along the roadside. But it is an essential, one of the essential qualifications for an elder, that he is hospitable. And this simply, I understand it to be, he welcomes people into his home, and maybe he goes a little out of his way to invite people into his home. And sometimes this one is kind of laid upon the feet of the women, because and I understand why, but the qualification of being hospitable is not for the elder's wife, it's for the elder. But certainly if a man is married to a woman that's not going to share the desire to be hospitable, it would make it considerably more difficult, maybe impossible, but it's considerably more difficult. But this, in our day and age, I think, is someone who welcomes people into his home, or when he sees, say, a visitor in our assembly, maybe he makes sure that they have an opportunity to visit. And in our day and age, that could be inviting him to go out to dinner with you on Sunday so you can get to visit him. But if you've got a little extra pot roast, it's always nice to have them in the home, because there's nothing like a kitchen table or a dining room table to really get to visit people. They may not be able to come, but they will remember being asked. But I think that is part of it. But it can't be an elder or an officer here can't be someone who doesn't enjoy being with people and isn't more than willing to share what he has in a hospitable way. And there are some people that just aren't hospitable, or there are some that it is harder to be hospitable. I think some people are just naturally gregarious, and that helps. But I think it's something that we can all work on. Being the recipient of much hospitality, I can tell you that it does not go unnoticed, and it does not go unappreciated. I think this can also be outside of the assembly. One of the congregations that I worked with helped establish not too long ago, one of their newest members was because a lady in the community had fallen, and broken her ankle. The sisters of the congregation just went to her. And they took food. They helped with her kids. And she and her husband and family have now been members of the church for the last probably 12 or 13 years. Does it always work out that way? No. Do you do it just for that? No. But it can be a well-received evangelistic tool, just treating people well. And our leaders ought to be an example of that, but that doesn't excuse the rest of us from that. Does anybody have a comment or a question on hospitality? I don't want to belabor it, but it is equally important as the others. Okay, I'm going to drop down now into verse 3. Let me. Oh, yeah. I want to drop down and pick up patience, because I don't believe I had spoken on patience. The Greek word there for an elder being patient is epikeia, and it means to be suitable, fair, reasonable, kind. Really, it would fit right into neighborly, as the teachers are teaching our youngsters. But it also carries the idea of someone who is not quick on the trigger, does not have a trigger temper, if you will. And, you know, it falls into the striker and the broiler, the brawler also, which we have there right with it in verse 3. He's to be patient, not a brawler. This is someone who is pugnacious, kind of a my way or the highway type of an attitude. It may connotate physical pugnaciousness more than just verbal and attitudinal pugnaciousness that maybe patience and striker carried with it. But it's not someone that is going to settle disagreements with physical means. Someone after church asked me, how long do you be patient with someone who's disrupting the assembly? It could be a false teacher. When I was growing up, there were two older boys that would sit on the back row and intentionally talk through the service. Intentionally talk. To the point he just disrupted the service. And the elders, I can remember, and I was very young, I was probably no more than 10. I can remember the elders asking them repeatedly to not do that. Eventually, when they didn't respond to that, and I'm talking about multiple times, multiple assemblies, they were asked to either, my words, hush or leave, because it was not allowing other members to have their minds centered where they should be. So there is a limit, not to our patience, but sometimes our patience has to take a different form or leads to a slightly different activity. It must not be covetous, we find here in verse 3. Covetousness is condemned in many places in the Old Testament. It's the 10th of the Ten Commandments. And it's been said it almost covers the last 6, because murder, stealing, adultery all have to do with coveting something. And I think that's a valid statement. But here it probably comes from a Greek word that means to be free of extreme greed for material things and not wanting things that are unnecessary or unneeded. Avarice is a word that's sometimes applied to this, and avarice is simply the extreme greed for material things. In 1 Peter chapter 5, one of the attributes of an elder there is must not be greedy for filthy lucre. It goes right along with that, and we've got that in these also. It's someone who does not want what they don't have or they don't have a right to. And certainly I think that attitude is pretty obvious. In verse 6, we have not a novice. I think the meaning there is very clear. I don't want to be overly deleterious of it. But developing these qualifications for an officer does not happen overnight. I think maybe Monday night I mentioned, when the Holy Spirit was active in a different way in the first century, maybe these things happened a little quicker. Maybe the Holy Spirit would work in men to help them develop these things quicker. But in our day and age, I believe the Holy Spirit does help us, but it takes a period of time and effort in order to develop these things. So an elder should not be regardless of his charisma or capability. It's not someone who's new to the faith. It's not someone who necessarily speaks overly well. It's someone that has honed these skills and made them part of his character. You might remember in Hebrews chapter 5, Paul, or the writer of Hebrews, whoever it was, says that when for a time you ought to be teachers. These were people that weren't growing as readily as the author of Hebrews thought would be appropriate for them to grow. And that lack of growth would inhibit. And you've probably all seen people who just catch fire and they just grow so rapidly in the faith. And then you see some others that are in the pews for decades, and you just kind of wonder, well, what's going on? Well, we can't see the heart. We can't see the mind. But this is not to be an overly young person. It wasn't in this state, so I'll use this as an example. And these are two very, very good men. But I remember seeing them put in their late 20s as elders. And there's no age here on it. But having said that, they had rather young children. And in looking at their situation, and they're both now older than I am, I think it took a toll on their family. And they would probably both say, I wish we'd have waited just a little bit longer to get our family a little bit more mature. You can do a man a great deal of, or a family a great deal of disservice, by placing things on them that they just don't yet have the time for. If you're raising a handful of kids, that's going to be a very time-consuming thing. But as they mature, it's not quite as time-consuming, and maybe you can work it in. You have to evaluate that, but I think the novice is not, what I'm trying to say, the novice is not only the development of knowledge and the strengthening of faith, it's also the development of the family, so that the man, be he a deacon or be he an elder, is in a little bit better position to be gone some nights a week when it's harder when you have a lot of youngsters there. In Titus chapter 1, verse 7, and I'm going to talk about a few that we find in Titus rather that aren't in Timothy, not to be self-willed. The Greek term there is ma'atheta, which is really the concept of not being headstrong, self-pleasing, or arrogant. And just to put it in my terms, a self-willed person is going to kind of take the attitude, my way or the highway. And if you have that attitude, that's not going to blend with other officers. It's not going to blend well with the congregation. Now, if you want to say the Lord's way or the highway, I can get a little more comfortable with that, but that still needs to be done with patience, and it needs to be expressed properly. But self-willed is a very self-centered, self-indulgent, presumptuous, self-pleasing attitude that is not to be part of the eldership. Let me pause. I covered probably four or five. Don't know that you have any comments on them. I'm not trying to fail to do them justice. We just have X amount of minutes to cover the material that we've been asked to cover. Okay, got you in a semi-coma position, so I will continue. Titus 1:7 has the concept of must not be soon angry. And Jesus talks about this in the Sermon on the Mount, about if you become angry and wroth. The Greek term here is mala aglion, and it means not to become irritable or prone to anger or irascible. Now, I believe anger has a place in the Christian's life. I do believe anger has a place that Paul says, be angry and sin not. He doesn't say don't ever get angry. Probably, though, most of us struggle with inappropriate anger versus appropriate anger. And by that I mean we tend to get angry when we feel somebody has wronged us. We probably should get less angry when we feel like we've been wronged and more angry when God has been wronged. So we've got a little bit of a missed target there. When I or when you see people that are seemingly trying to hurt the church, that causes me to become angry. I hope I don't sin, but my tolerance level for people that are trying to hurt the church through false teaching or whatever isn't terribly, terribly high. Jesus drove the money changers out. We often talk about that. But he was always controlled. He was always controlled in his reaction. And I think whether we're talking about drugs or alcohol, Christians are to be under control. But there is maybe a place for anger. And this doesn't say an elder cannot be angry. He just said, don't be soon angry. This has to do with that flash point. And if somebody has a low or a quick flash point, that's not going to serve them or the congregation well. In Titus chapter 1, verse 8, they must be a lover of good men. Some of our liberal Bible students have enjoyed taking that as a pro-homosexual comment. It's obviously not even close to that. That's a gross misconduct. It does, however, carry the idea of having affection for people that are good and having being a lover of goodness, being a lover of what is good, being gentle. And I think common sense tells us all that, so I'm not going to again belabor that. In 1 John chapter 3, verse 14, it says, we know that we have passed from death into life. How? Because we love the brethren. What did Jesus say in the Gospel of John? By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. And I think that's the underwriting concept that I believe that Paul here, whether he's writing to Timothy or to Titus, is trying to give us. Two more that I find in Titus that aren't exactly the way Paul mentions them to Timothy. In Titus chapter 1, verse 8, they must be just. It carries the idea of fair and upright in our dealings with one another. There's one that we talked about earlier, being of good report. I think that has to do with treating people fairly. So that not only our brethren consider us to be fair men, our neighbors consider us to be fair men. The people we work with consider us to be fair people. The people that engage in us in any way would come away saying that's a fair-minded, just individual, upright, honest in his dealings with other people, rendering to each person their appropriate dueness without partiality or without favoritism. And then in verse 8 of Titus 1, it says they must be holy. It's a Greek word used by the Holy Spirit is hosion. And it's defined as pious, devout, and religious. Now, I want to turn to Titus chapter 1 and point out one that is very important in my evaluation of people. And it's not unlike what we had in Timothy. It's just expressed a little bit different. And that's in verse 9. Holding fast the faithful word. I'm in Titus 1. Holding fast the faithful word, as he hath been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and to convince the gainsayer. And I believe I mentioned that last night. This has to do with being apt to teach. But it also has to do with having the knowledge to aptly teach. And one of the powerful lessons or responsibilities of an elder, and I believe of a deacon also, is the concept of being able to stand for the doctrine and to oppose false teaching for the protection of the flock. And numerous times throughout, Paul uses the concept of grievous wolves that will come in. He tells the elders at Ephesus, You got to be on guard. It's interesting that Paul also says that come from within. False teachers don't always come from without. Sometimes they come from within, within the congregation. And when that happens, they're probably harder for us to spot. And a good elder has to be alert for that. The very concept of shepherd, which is one of the terms for that's used for elder, has to do with protecting the flock. And I think this ninth verse in Titus chapter 1 is an extremely important verse. I've seen men who had Bible knowledge, but wouldn't necessarily be able to articulate it in a way that I think could carry out verse 9. Or they might be eloquent and not have the Bible knowledge to carry out what I see here in verse 9. It is a combination of both. And I'm not saying they have to be all PhD linguists. Probably better off if they're not. But they have to be willing and courageous enough and knowledgeable enough to protect the flock. Anybody have a comment or a question on any of these qualifications, or have I missed one that you want me to talk about? I haven't intentionally missed one. Some of them are just more easily understood and applied, not necessarily more easily done than others. Okay, let's spend a little bit of time on some of these questions that I gave you because I thought they were all valid. Last night I was talking about, and somebody asked the question, I don't remember who, maybe a man has three children, and two of them have accepted the Lord, and one of them's younger and hasn't accepted the Lord. And it prompted a parent to ask me in the parking lot, how do you know when your children are ready to accept the Lord? Well, that's probably a question that almost every parent who has children of very high age has pondered and wondered about. My answer to them, and then I'll open it up for your comments, is I tend to ask young people just some very basic questions. Do you believe Jesus is the Son of God? And why do you want to be baptized? And if they can give me a yes, and then I might follow that up to see, well, what does that mean that he's the Son of God? And if they could say, I want to be baptized for the remission of my sins, and we talk a little bit about what is sin and what all that is. If you get the right answers, and you can make your little list of 3 to 7 questions, I don't know how many. When I get the right answers to those very basic questions, I get very uncomfortable telling a youngster no, because I don't know how they're going to react. I have seen parents that have had children come that have been 8, 9 years old, and most of us might say, well, I wish they were a little older, but you say no when they seem to understand. Sometimes they never do come to the Lord, and I struggle with having that on my conscience. Would we probably prefer that they were a tad older? Well, maybe. But if they have been raised in the church, as many of you have been and many of your children have been, they're going to possibly come to it a little quicker than if they hadn't been raised in the church. But one of the things you want to guard against is they're not doing it to make you or Grandpa happy. It will make you and Grandpa happy, but that can't be the reason for doing it. And children do like to please us, despite what you sometimes think during the day. I know. But they do really like to want to please us. So I don't mind sharing this. It's not a magic number. I was 14. For me, that just seems like just the right number. But that doesn't mean it's the right number for anybody else. But for me, it was. My sister was probably 9 or 10. And that may have been the right number for her. But I do know the feeling of your children, one of my children started getting a little older. Not old, but just a little older. And I begin to think, is he ever going to click in? Well, I'll just be honest. It just was hard for me not to get him by to say, come on, we're going to baptize you whether you're ready or not. And I'm being a little facetious. You get so anxious and concerned. He came down the stairs one day and said, it would be okay if I was baptized tonight. And I thought, well, we can probably work that in, as I was going, yeah. But children are different. He's like me. If Donna or I had said something to him about it, it would have probably delayed it several years. Or it might not have ever happened. Because Many of us don't like to be pushed. We like to be nurtured. So be patient. Be patient. If you're teaching them right and they're good kids, it usually does happen. But there's a reason God didn't put an age on it, because it varies. It varies with child. It varies with circumstances. Does anybody want to make a comment on that? That was basically what I said to this individual. And okay, I'm happy if you're happy. Didn't see a hand. Can an elder be removed once he's put into office? Well, the answer to that is yes. An elder can be removed once he is put into office. I would turn to, 1 Timothy chapter 5, and point out a couple of verses. One which I think doesn't apply, that is sometimes applied, and then another couple of verses that do apply to this. The ones that I think don't apply, in my opinion, are verses 1 and 2. I'm in 1 Timothy chapter 5. It says, "Rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father." And I have heard elders say, "You can't chastise me because it says rebuke not an elder." I believe that's taking that passage out of context. I think the word elder there does not mean the office. Elder there means an older man, because in verse 2 it talks about the elder women. So I think, to be consistent, that verse to me is saying let's treat old people nice. But it's not. It has nothing to do with the office of elder as I view it. Now, having said that, when I drop down to verse 19 and 20, well, let me do 18. Well, let me do 17. Let the elders that rule well, now we're talking about the office, elders that rule well, be counted worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in the word of doctrine. And I mentioned the other night that I think that's a passage that legitimately could, the concept of double honor could allow there to be spiritual honor and financial honor if the congregation chose to do it. Then in verse 18, I'll read through 20. "For the scripture saith, thou shalt not muzzle an ox that treadeth out the corn, and the laborer is worthy of his reward." In other words, if an elder is working diligently and it's appropriate and there's a need to support them emotionally, spiritually, and financially, I think that verse is saying that. But then in verse 19 it says, "Against an elder," now we're still, I believe, talking about the office, "against an elder receive not an accusation, but before two or three witnesses." And that concept of two or three witnesses is what we see throughout the Old Testament. In Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15, take two witnesses. That was a very Jewish, Old Testament, Mosaical tradition. It can't, if you're going to be accused, you need to, it can't just be one person. And then he says, in verse 20, "them that sin rebuke before all, and others may also may fear." I believe verse 20 applies to all of us. All Christians who sin can be chastised or rebuked before the congregation. But since it follows so obviously closely with verse 19, I think probably Paul's intent here was to tell Timothy, if there is an accusation against an elder, it needs to be two or three witnesses. But if it's valid, then there needs to be a rebuke to the whole congregation. Fortunately, that happens very seldom in my experience. Maybe in your experience it hasn't happened. It happens more frequently. Last Labor Day, one of the speakers, and it wasn't me, reminded us that it needs to be sin. This is not, I'm upset with somebody because they, whatever. If it's not a sin, I don't know that that accusation has any validity to remove a man from office. If it is a sin, it doesn't mean that the man has to be removed. He has to be rebuked, and hopefully that will lead to a change in that. And it could be of such a sin that the man couldn't function. If he's stealing money from the church treasury, that's not good for a deacon. Well, it's not good for anybody, but the deacons tend to handle the finances a little bit more, and you would have to take that very, very seriously. Obviously, areas of morality affect this. So I believe an elder can be removed, but it is a very serious action. And I have seen it done a few times appropriately, but when you start destabilizing an eldership, you better be very careful what you're doing, because there can be multiple ramifications to it. We need to be prudent enough to think not only about the single step, but the second, the third, and the fourth step, the ripple effect of it. If it's a sin and it's not repented of, then I think it's obviously much more crystal clear. But if it can be repented of, or it's areas of judgment, I don't agree with my elders all the time. And it's not because that I'm right. Sometimes they are right. It's in areas of judgment. And so I try to be very respectful of them, and I understand their judgment's as good as mine or better in some areas. So, but an elder can be removed. That's my response. Very thoughtfully and very carefully. Alan? Well, his question is, I'll repeat it. Well, you repeat it.
My question is, if this would be the responsibility of the evangelist, just as he would be appointed by an evangelist.
Okay. My answer to that, in my opinion, is yes. And I'll tell you why. Number one, in Titus, Paul tells Titus to set things in order, which I think this is could be part of that. And also here in Timothy, Timothy was an evangelist, and we see him called an evangelist in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 5. So, and Paul is writing to an evangelist, and he says, against an elder, receive not an act. This seems to be Paul giving the evangelist Timothy instructions on how to proceed. Now, if you take the position that it's not an evangelist, then you might be left with the other elders in the church. I think what we're being told here is this would be an opportunity maybe to bring someone in that's not as emotionally charged and can maybe be a little more objective on both sides. So that would be my recommended preference. But I do know, and I have respect for people that would say, no, an evangelist shouldn't do this. But that seems to me to be what is being said. Anybody else want to comment on this? I was involved in a congregation in another state, and they had four elders. And at one time were extremely strong. One of them resigned. The other one was removed. And quickly the other two resigned. And make a long story short, they went from four elders to none in just a matter of months. Now, does that mean that it was done wrong? No. I just use that as an indication of when we destabilize an organization, we just need to be real sure of what we're doing. And removing an officer, deacon or elder, has a destabilizing effect. But if it is sin, then it's much more destabilizing to leave the man in. And that's a disaster. So prayerful judgment and love. Because anytime we have to do something like this, our goal is to restore that person, not to punish them. There may be a sense of punishment there. But any kind of discipline in the church, to me, its goal is to restore, not to cast out. Sometimes we have to cast out in order for that to happen, but that's not our preferred way. Brian has a comment. Marty, Ryan, Engel, Jamie's husband.
Now him?
Yes.
He's trying to ignore him.
Oh, I don't want to do that. Would it almost be a better recommendation that if you do have a concern towards an elder, that you would actually reach out to an evangelist before you bring other members of the congregation in just to get their take on it before you start causing rifts inside the church?
That might be appropriate, but I thought you were going to say, and I was hoping you were going to say, the first step's to reach out to him. Matthew chapter 18. If you got something against someone, you go talk to them. How many things would be resolved if we just did it the way the Lord told us to do, rather than buzzing around all to each other and getting all in a hubbub before we even go and talk to the man? So I think that the three-step approach in Matthew 18, go to them. If you won't listen, take someone with you. Then eventually it gets brought to the congregation. But God always wants us to handle these things at the lowest level possible, because some of these are very private. And the man might respond. The man might respond. Now, you didn't say this, so I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think it's not appropriate to go to someone else, be it an evangelist or anybody else, and say, you go talk to them. If it's bad enough, you go talk to them. You know, and that's what the Bible teaches. Where are we at here, Lowell?
This is Moles, another state also. Back in verse 17 on that 1 Timothy 5, mine says that elders who are good leaders are to be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. I think there's an abuse by some people that claim to be Christians on taking it kind of on themselves to be the elder, and that might be where we get the full-time preacher, and they consider themselves an elder. Maybe they have another person that's in the office that doesn't do the things that one. But I ran into that in Texas, I think.
Okay, that was a period?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's abusive.
Your voice didn't drop, but I didn't know if you were done. Well, there are people who want the authority of an elder without the responsibility of an elder. It doesn't have to be preachers. I've seen that happen in congregations. But that's inappropriate. I mean, an elder should be, and deacons can delegate to keep the congregation participatory. I think that's very important. But there are some things you can't delegate away, and it just falls at you. A man can't delegate ruling his home well to somebody else. That's his responsibility. And protecting the flock, an elder can't delegate that away. Now, he can ask for help, but it's his responsibility. And I'm not saying that's what you were saying. Yeah, there are times when people try to take over the elder's authority and power or responsibility. But that I don't think is ever appropriate. They can augment it, they can help it, but it's the elder in the spiritual realm that has this responsibility. Okay. Let's see. Can one recover from not being qualified? And what the person, I believe, had in mind here was, let's say the person has a problem with anger, or they have a problem with being a striker, whatever, or with wine. It doesn't matter. And they correct that problem. Can they now be qualified once they've corrected that problem? I believe they can. Now, there might be cases where a man's corrected it, but his reputation has taken a real hit with the congregation, that he would not, at least immediately or maybe never, have the confidence of the congregation. But if one corrects a wrong, and literally, I mean really corrects it, not just doing it till you get in, but literally corrects it, and God helps them, whether it's a temper problem or an anger problem, I think that is quite feasible. Most of us, when we were 20, didn't have all these qualifications. You have to work on them. You have to become more patient. You have to become more this, more that, and then that's part of the growth process. But just because, and I'll just say anger, for instance, just because a man has an anger problem at one stage in his life, if he can correct that, literally, and to the satisfaction of the congregation, then I wouldn't know how to oppose that man based upon that. Comments, questions on that one? Tom?
John, just thinking about elders and having a backbench, if you will, of elders who are a backbench, guys ready to step in when it's time. Mm-hmm. marriage seems to be a big obstacle. Where do we stand on marriage? Is it the husband of one lawful wife or the husband of just one wife his whole time? Where do we stand to determine if a man's eligible regarding marriage?
Okay, we talked about that earlier, but let me just give a brief recap of that. I understand that passage is he is the husband of one wife, present tense. And so I believe husband of one wife rules out polygamy. And I believe it, but I don't believe it always rules out that he may have had more than one wife. For instance, if a man's wife dies and he remarries, I don't have a passage that can tell me he can't be an elder, because I believe he had every right to remarry. Where this really comes up is when there's a divorce involved. And to me, that's a more difficult area. As I said when we discussed this, and good people don't always see it this way, if a man has a scriptural right to remarry, and God blesses that marriage, I don't have a verse that I can point to say he can't be an elder. Having said that, that to me raises a real red flag that ought to be thoroughly investigated, because seldom is all of the blame on one side of the coin, even though we don't know what's going on. So it certainly could often be a red flag that would tell me it's best that we not put that man in. I know of a few men who have been put in as elders. I have never put in a divorced man as an elder, and probably won't, just because I'd rather be safe than sorry. But can I condemn it in every possible scenario? I don't have a chapter and verse to condemn it, if God blesses that marriage. Now, if it's not a scriptural remarriage, then obviously the answer is no. And that's about as good as I can do on that. I hope it's right. Anybody else have a comment on this? Can a man recover from it? Okay, number three. May not get all of them, but we'll get this one. What about an officer that's too busy or distracted to perform the office? Well, if a man is too busy or too distracted to perform the office, whether it is a deacon or whether it is an elder, you got a problem, because he's not functioning as he agreed to. Hopefully, if he's too busy to, he shouldn't have been put in, but sometimes elements change. I would go and talk to them and say, hey, you know, we need you, and you just don't seem to have the time to do the job now. You'd put it in more loving words than what I just said, because I don't have time to be loving right now. I'm looking at the clock. But I also see a distinction between a long-term pattern and a short-term pattern. For instance, a man's wife might become ill, and it just consumes him to take care. I've seen this with dementia and Alzheimer's. That's different than if it's a long-term, ongoing, no light at the end of the tunnel. I think I'd be patient with someone who's got a spatial, limited-time blur. Anybody can get really busy at work for a few months. I understand that. But when you get to a case where the person can't order their days, or it just is so consuming that they don't have time to do it, I would hope that person, if they couldn't handle the busyness, would step aside, because they're not able to function as an officer. It doesn't mean they're immoral. It doesn't mean they're not Christians. It just means they don't have the time or can't find the time to do the job. That's one of the reasons I'm also cautious on putting men in too young. Because if you're raising a whole bunch of kids and trying to get your career going so you can afford more than a one-bedroom house, that's time-consuming. And you might want to wait till you can catch your breath a little bit and do the job right. So I think that can be a problem, and hopefully the person would see that is a problem. If it's a long-term problem, might even step aside in that case, because it's putting an unfair burden on his fellow officers for several reasons. Now, if he won't step aside, then the congregation has to make a judgment call. Is it such that we can't function, or is it better to be patient and And that's a case-by-case thing. But I do believe people can get so busy or allow themselves to get so busy that they no longer can do the job that they agreed to do. And I hope I would step aside if that was me. Anybody else want to comment on that one? Okay. I don't know how to really say this one, but one person was talking to me this week, and they commented how crucial communication is in both the eldership and the deaconship. And I couldn't say amen to that any louder and any longer. And again, does the Bible say, I think the principle is here, the precept isn't. Officers that don't meet regularly to discuss issues, that's beyond my grasp, to be blunt with you. Elders certainly need to have their own meetings, but there are times when elders and deacons should have, I believe, meetings. Because the deacons may want to pave the parking lot, and that might cost $20,000, to which the elders then can't spend that money having spiritual things done. And I think they're both right. There has to be this communication. And, I shouldn't even worry about this. I'll obviously worry in just a little bit, but I'm still going to say it. Congregations should have open books, and I believe should have business meetings. Now, in the experiences I've had, many times not very many people come to the business meeting. Okay. They had their chance. You know, speak now or forever hold your peace. But I think this area of communication within officers, within a congregation, so many problems happen because of lack of communication. Now, they can get frustrated. My sons, they're not officers. They get frustrated at our business meetings because they tend to spend 80% of it talking about what color to paint the air conditioner. And you've sat through those meetings. They're frustrating. They're frustrating. And they could care less. And so maybe we need to focus our business in the most important areas. Now, I'm giving you my opinion. I'm not giving you legislation. Each congregation is autonomous, but I just think it's a healthy environment. The more we can get everybody participatory, the stronger the congregation is going to get, as long as it's doctrinally correct. My home congregation, go ahead, Mark. No, I was just going to say, my home congregation, we're about 130, and we could easily hire somebody to clean and to mow the grass. And if you do that, that's fine. There's obviously nothing wrong with that. We intentionally don't do that because it gives people who aren't comfortable from the pulpit a chance to feel like they're doing something for the group. And we got guys that just love to mow. You're not looking at one of them. Or people that love to clean. No, I don't know if they love. But they clean the building when they don't feel they can do other things. My point is, the more participatory we become, the stronger we can become as a family. Marty?
I guess my question was, in your experience, do most congregations you visit have business meetings, or there are some that do, some that don't?
There's some that do and some that don't, but the majority of them do. Now, the frequency of them might be a different issue. But I have gone to congregations, and they come to me, a visiting evangelist. The members come to me and say, do you know how much money we've got? I got no idea. I don't want to know. I just know they're not communicating. And I don't know that the deacons have to get down to the penny, but the congregation should have an idea of what's our resources available. And if we ever have to take disciplinary action on a member, that's a congregational activity led by the elders, if that ever happens. So I think there's some benefit to that, but I defer to wiser judgments in some cases, but I've always felt better about that. Anybody else? Okay. Let me see. Oh, I'll get this one in. this one's kind of interesting because I never thought about it. We talked about children leaving the home and then the father's no longer responsible. I was asked, is there a time lag? How long do the children have to be gone before he's not responsible for them? I never thought of it. It's not a terrible question. To me, if the child has grown and has gone, got a good job and has moved out of the house, apartment house, then he's no longer under the home. But I can see a case where a 16-year-old kid gets mad because they don't buy the dress they want or they don't get the car they want, so they run away from home. Pretty good chance they're going to come back. Well, you might want to give a little bit of time lag on that. So, boy, that looks kind of nice. I didn't even ring the bell, and they're being good neighbors. Good neighbors. I will ring. Okay, tomorrow night I want to get into a little bit about the duties of an elder and a deacon. But I know Marty, at least with this, some in this group, covered some of that. But I'd also like to talk a little bit about the duty of the membership to the leadership.